I'd like to just make a request that the dog on the top bunk in Mitnick's room remain kind of a stable member of our Chabura community. I'm getting used to him at this point, or her, or them, but I really like it, and I hope it stays around. Just wanted to share that.
Any particular philosopher's names that you've associated with this dog?
Schiller. Schiller. Great. It is Schiller.
Great request, Cole. I should say, Cole mentioned something that I should mention to everybody else. If it, later in the year, there's, like, a topic that anybody, like, wants to, like, give, like, just present, I'm happy to yield the microphone to somebody else for a topic. So, you know, if you see down the line that we're going to cover something in Shomrim or the Yored Sugya, and, you know, your heart really moves you to want to present it, and I'm happy to let you present it. And we can even just talk about it before you present, to figure out how you would do it. But I'm really happy to let other people present every now and then if that's something that people want. All right, so we have today the Tshuva Sarashpa. One comment before we get to the Tshuva Sarashpa, I know we discussed the Marshach last time. I thought it was important to draw attention to the fact that Rabbi Akiva Eiger in Choshen Mishpat Siman Gimel makes this Marshach famous. So he talks here about he summarizes the Marshach, and I think the fact that Rabbi Akiva Eiger quotes it in Shulchan Aruch gives it a lot more normative street credibility. So I think people might be hesitant just to lean on the Marshach, but the fact that Rabbi Akiva Eiger just kind of accepts it really moved this Marshach into the mainstream of halacha when it comes to relying on these kinds of minhag ha-sochrim.
Methodologically, do you think that when Rabbi Akiva quotes something, that means that he agrees with it, or was it just a memory thing for him to write down on the side, or like how exactly do you attribute those?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't have strong views on it. I haven't really researched it, but definitely in the way it's used, it's not like Ayin Marshach. It's like Ayin Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you know, Shehevi Me Marshach. And it's cited that way authoritatively. So just looking around, it seems like the impression is that Rabbi Akiva Eiger is quoting it because it's like a normative view. You'll see, I mean, well, there's an interesting methodological question in the Ramah that we'll see today in how he cites the Tshuva Sarashpa. But this, I think just the general Derech HaMelech is that this Rabbi Akiva Eiger is citing it authoritatively. So let's take up this Tshuva Sarashpa. You could see this Tshuva Sarashpa is like the holy grail of trying to figure out the interaction between kind of the halacha in its purest form and the halacha as incorporating the minhag ha-sochrim. And it's really a difficult Rashpa to try to make sense of, right? To figure out what the line is that he's drawing. And it's even more confusing because the poskim seem to run with the Rashpa in a different direction, specifically that Rama. So let's talk about the little story here that we get from the Shiloh. So there are two parts of the Shiloh. You'll notice the Beis Yosef seems to leave out one part of it. Some people think that's really important for understanding the Beis Yosef. You have the story in Perpignan, so somewhere in Provence, where Reuven marries off his daughter Leah to Shimon. He gives her a nice dowry to bring into the marriage. They have a daughter. Leah dies, and then the daughter dies. And the dispute is over who gets to keep the dowry. Now, if you know a little bit about, if you learn Ksivis, you probably have seen that, like, who gets the dowry is, like, a big question that the Rishonim are all worried about. There are takanos about this. It seems there was this concern that a woman would get married, bring a lot of money into the marriage, and then the husband would get a windfall if she died early on. So there's like all these takanos to protect the assets of the wife in case she died like within the first year of marriage or without children, to give the assets, the dowry, back to her parents' family, to her side of the family. So you get a version of that here, just without the takana, right? So the father of the deceased wife, he gets up, and we get this statement, he's Toveya Bedine Hagayim, She yachzir lo osa mamon hanedunya. She hichnis lo im leibito. So he sues bedine hagayim, and I think that phrase is ambiguous, whether it means he sues in a non-Jewish court or he's suing on the basis of the non-Jewish law to recover the dowry that he had given to the marriage. Now, the father of the deceased wife recognizes that in Jewish law, the Baal is Yoresh Ishto, and that Av as Bito, meaning that the husband, even if the assets went to the daughter that was born to the marriage, the husband would inherit her, would inherit his daughter nonetheless. Toein v'omer she'ein lachosh li'irusha sabal, kivan she'akol yodim she'ein holchen b'dine agayim. So this is like a really strong statement that everybody knows that in Perpignan, the heim holchen b'dine agayim. And it's not clear if that phrase should be interpreted to mean broadly that the Jewish community of Perpignan just always followed Dine Hagayim for all its commercial and monetary disputes, or this is like a narrower phrase about their practice with respect to Yerusha and where the dowry goes in a case like this. And he proceeds to say, V'harei kol anose isha sham ki ilu hisnekein. And anybody who gets married there, it's as if they make a tanai. And just recall that we're in the language of the Shoel still, so it's hard to read too much into it. But also, even if we wanted to medayik here, this ki'ilu hisnekein says if it's a tanai, is a little ambiguous between the two different possibilities that we've been exploring until now. Right? It says if you made a tanai, it's not clear that would mean that the halachic basis here is the basis of kol tanai shev mamon. We don't have to worry about this right now, but the Shoel appeals to the Sugyan Ksuvis that in places where people do a lot of commerce in Metaltalin, a wife could be Gove her Ksuva from Metaltalin, even though Medina de Gemara, it seems like you wouldn't. And then the Shoel proceeds to say, V'al Yerusha Sa'av B'nichzei Abbas, meaning the husband, with respect to his right to inherit the daughter that was born to the marriage, that should be overridden as well, because HaMelech Chakak B'nimusav Shekol Shiyamusav La'ad Toch Zman Yedua Shiyehe Ma Sheyesh L'mitzad Ha'im L'yor Sheyaim V'dina L'vachus Adina. So it's just clear from the Shaila here that there are two separate legal points. One is and then separately with respect to the husband inheriting his daughter, to the contrary, and we should follow the Dina de Machus Adina. That's just a brief statement of the question. Let me spend 1 minute talking about his answer, and then we'll get into our discussion. So the Rashba... What's that?
Do you think we could understand from the fact that the second Shaila is specific, we could probably interpret that the first one is not a Jewish, not a Narcolis question, because if it was, and it sounds like it's, we have something that's on the books, meaning the Yerusha Sabbat, and we have something that's not on the books, just the Minhag, and presumably in Beis Din. I don't think it affects the broader issues that much.
You're saying, does this distinction here between Chaka Kamelach Bini Musav, you're saying why is this only brought up in the second part, not in the first part?
Yeah, I say that there is possible to read that first half of Bedine Hagoyim as in non-Jewish court, but then it would functionally be the same question of the same legal principle in question of, are we following Dina de Malchusa or are we following Halacha? Whereas, like, it seems like the first half is a more ambiguous, it's just what people do type thing, and everyone knows that that's what we do.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I see what you're getting at. First of all, Din, it's good to have you live in person, so welcome.
Good to be live.
Yeah, you've been pretty active on the WhatsApp.
That's my only, like, hold a second, it's my only simulacrum of of engagement. I gotta take advantage of what I have.
Right, well, good to have you. I would say, I think my response to that is that my impression is that the second half of the question is did not like rise to the level of like the accepted practice in the Jewish community. right? So all he has to base his argument in is Dina de Machlus Adina. Whereas the first part of the tshuva was clearly accepted by the Jewish community, or was their practice, and therefore he's able to say, you know, Akol Yodim Shem Holchem Adina Agayim.
Maybe even though that, even though the minhag is less, I don't know, entrenched in terms of like a searchable law, it has greater halachic weight because of its acceptance in the Jewish community.
Well, I would say that maybe both of them have equal. They're equally enshrined in the non-Jewish law. Like they're both like Chakak HaMelech B'nei Musav, arguably. But the first one is like a clear Kol Yodim Shem Holchem Adina Agayim, maybe on this fact, on this issue. And the second one, maybe less so, right? And so he has to hang his hat on Dina de Machlus Adina.
Got it.
That's what I would say. I could be wrong. I'm happy to consider other readings of it.
And ultimately, I was saying, just trying to make a diuk in, what is the, is this Yerusha Sahav also a law, or is it just a minhag in for the non-Jews in Provence, is Yerusha Sa'av a law or a minhag? But ultimately it doesn't really affect the point of what the halacha is for Jews in terms of the sugya, it's seeing what does the, whether it's a legal principle, whether it's a din d'vel chukus question or it's a minhag question, it's a question of the acceptance in the das or whatever you want to call it of the Jews is ultimately what matters more.
Right. So I think they could equally be Chakak HaMelech B'nei Musav, but the first one you have clear communal acceptance as enshrined in the communal practice. For the second one, it sounds like it's exclusively a Din Rachusa question. So the Rashba starts off, and notice he discusses Kol Davar Shebe Mamon Tana Okayim, which I think lends some credence to the view that when we try to figure out a Kol Kamina Gamadina, maybe it actually is grounded in the specific ruling of Kol Tanai Shebe Mamon Kayim. I think that's probably just the straightforward best way to interpret that phrase and why the Rashba starts off with it. And then he says, "V'emes amru shemasin b'cheinyan zeh," right? So he says there actually are clear Gemaras that take a stance on this. Like we know from the Yushalmi, "Hani dekasvin and misis b'lobanim tahader mahara l'beinasha." So we know from the Yushalmi that you can make an explicit tenai that if the wife dies without children, the dowry goes back to the wife's family, and because Tanai Mamon Kayim, right? Tanai Mamon Vikayim. That's just like a monetary agreement, and therefore it's Kayim. So the Rashba has no problem with that. The Rashba himself is willing to go further, which I think is just the Rashba's explicit about this, which is nice. Shebechol Makom Shenagu Lahasnos Velasos Kazeh Tanai Afilu Anosim Shem Stam. Govin mehen and mesa blabanim shakala nose stam al dasa noik sham bisrael nose. So he's willing to say that even if you didn't have this tanai, we're willing to say that by default, you're embracing the noheg sham bisrael. And then I think this is really important, which we'll talk about later. He thinks that's related to this idea in the Gemara of being doresh lashon hedyot. So I want to. It's a very small aside here. He says Vizesha Karohu Biparaka Mekabel Drishas Hedyot. If you look at that sugi there, it's this whole sugi about Darshina Lashon Hedyot and what exactly that means. And there's another Tshuva Sarashba where he makes a big deal about that. So we'll talk about that more closely, how this is related to Darshina Lashon Hedyot. But then so it sounds like in the beginning of the Tshuva, the Rashba thinks this is all kosher, right? He starts off Kol Tanai Shebe Mamon Kayim. And even when they're not explicit, we could say that implicitly they've accepted this. So he's going with the flow and he seems totally fine with everything. Then he does his very strong about face, where he says, Linho kain mipnei shehu mishpat agayim, be'emes nir lisha asur, because it imitates the non-Jews and their laws and etc. And he has this whole thing, shelo nicha toras am shelo nachlala ritzonam shiakru es chukos agayim bedineyem, etc. Al kain anu po tmeim makom mishpa beircha makom torah v'yisran das echnasnu yad lechlal dvarim elu shastrasan torah shleima shalanu uma mamon yishane leire shaloke torah seinu. So it's hard to know what the Rashba does this about face, but how do you navigate the beginning of the tshuva where he seems fully on board kol tanai shav mamon kayim with his seeming retraction where he says, oh, this is horrible, and how did you allow this to come about? So let's hear, I just want to hear some of your thoughts here, and then, you know, we could talk about how the Achronim interpret this and some suggestions. Gabe?
I thought the simplest reading is that he's switching hats. He's taking off his Kosek hat and putting on his Gadol Ador hat or whatever. And this is a policy statement, not a halachic statement.
So flesh that out for me. So it's all kosher, right? But it's, you know, as like in the policy thing, it's not kosher.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it in two ways. Maybe I'll use more Torah language for now and then move away from policy. He's taking off his kosher mishpat hat and putting on his yordaya hat. He's saying, this is aser, it's a sort of not advisable practice. He uses the word chet at some point in this tshuva, which is interesting language. But on a kosher mishpat level, technically speaking, this tnai is kayem and valid, and we should follow the tnai.
Okay, so I think you're right. So it sounds like you're saying there's a distinction here between the Choshen Mishpat validity of the Tanai and its enforceability, and that should be distinguished from its permissibility, right? So it's impermissible, it was wrong for you to do this, but the Tanai is totally valid, right? So I agree with Gabe's point here. I don't think that fully explains the transition, but I do agree with Gabe's point that even when he says Nir Elisha Usser, he's not calling the legal validity of the agreement into question. Right? So it's like valid and enforceable, even if he thinks it's a bad thing to do. Right, Gabe? I take it that's your point?
Yeah, that is my point. The reason I brought in the word policy is because I think he's trying to make a broader point about... He doesn't want to be seen as giving a stamp of approval to this kind of practice.
Right.
And so that's a bigger question than just like the Isser Heter status of this contract.
I think the challenge then, if you're right, is, well, you know, what could be unkosher about the kind of the normative basis that he provides in the first part of the tshuva, right? Kol Tanai Shev Mamon Kayim. And, you know, b'makom shenagu lasos kein afilu min astam kol hanosei al das hanoig sham b'Yisrael nosei. So is the idea that even in a tnai shel mamon circumstance, this could be aser, right? Or is the idea that when he makes the move that min astam you're working a daita de minag, it's aser? If that's your view, then why doesn't that call all of a kol kaminag hamedina into iser territory? Right, so whenever the Mishnah is concluded with Hakol Kaminag HaMedina, you know, you don't get the sense that the halacha is frowning upon it. But on Gabe's reading, it sounds like the halacha should, or the halacha ought to frown on that kind of deferral to Kol Kaminag HaMedina. No, Gabe?
Wait, does that bring into question? I guess I hadn't thought meaningfully about it before. When we said Kol Kaminag HaMedina, is that, like, it could be that it's just, I think I just assumed that was the Jew, whatever the minhag in the Jewish town is or wherever you're living, that it's not necessarily, like, it doesn't directly bring in, like, a chukos tagoyim, a potential deoraisa, like, of the chukos saying, look, telechu. But here, that if we say that the stam minhag is perfectly aligned with the chakak hamelch ben Yusuf, then putting our stamp of approval on this minhag being in the background means that we're effectively concretizing the fact that every Jew is violating chukos hagoyim.
So,
like, if it's a real yoreday issue.
So what's your distinction, Adin?
The tension that the Rashbaz could be facing is that if we're saying that the king made a law and now the Jews are following that law and they're even following it, and that's even their default assumption when they're doing Kosher Mishpat interactions, then if we let that minhag, which has its roots in the Chukas HaGoyim, for that minhag kind of be the stam minhag that we're relying upon, it kind of entrenches a violation of, okay, if we don't have to, like, speak it into existence, okay, everyone's just following regular business practice. But if the law of the king has entrenched halakhic weight so much so that it's an applied full tnai mamon, then we're really entrenching the fact that we're violating.
Dean, you're confusing two different things. The case that the Rashba is talking about doesn't mention, at least a bit about the kind of the non-halachic inheritance process. I don't think it's mentioned that it was required by civil law to do this sort of thing. That it would be pretty. I think it would be like the halacha would be much more accommodating if you would like run afoul of the authorities if you didn't change the order of inheritance, at least in like a, you know, assuming it's just regular dine mamonos. The question here, or at least the way that it's asked, is so the father says, she'en l'chosh l'irush as ha-ba'al, kevan she'ako yodim she'en holkem v'dine ha-goyen, v'rei kol anose isha sham ki'ilu hasnaken. I think what the Rashba is worried about here is like not that Gentile practice like creeped into Jewish practice, but rather that such that like as a matter of empirical fact, Gentile practice and Jewish practice are identical, but rather it's like what he's worried about is the Jewish habit of looking to Gentile practice for legal guidance and basically using Gentile practice as a way to supplant Torah law. So actually, the Rashba has no problem.
Cool. I think I agree with the direction that you're going in.
I think I agree with that too. Maybe.
So Cole, I think what Cole's saying, Cole, you could flesh out your point. Let me just make sure that we're all on the same page here. I think Cole's point is that there's no problem with correspondence between the Jewish custom and the non-Jewish custom. It's also the case that there's no problem if the Jewish law, the Jewish practice intentionally mimics the non-Jewish practice in this area. I think you're saying like what the Rashba is upset about is just the general presumption that the Jewish practice will always just track.
Yeah, the first thing you said about correspondence, I agree with. If it so happens that the Jews are behaving like the Gentiles in an area of monetary law, the Rashba has no problem with that. What he doesn't like is the fact that, and again, if you don't know the empirical facts of the case, it's weird to say such a thing, but, and it could be that what you're saying is correct, Itamar, that really what he's worried about is kind of a narrow Isser point. But I think what he doesn't like is that the father is like, we're going to behave. It's either that the father is like an assimilated guy and he dafka wants to incorporate Gentile practice into Jewish practice. That would be an extreme thing, and I think uncontroversially usher to say like, actually we're, you know, to have a Jewish wedding and say like, no, we're gonna do this like the way the Goyim do it because it's the way the Goyim do it. That'd be the worst thing.
I think Cole froze for a second there. I mean,
I think I agree with what he's saying in the sense that, like, in the Lashon of the Rashba's question, it's the fact that we're assuming that the default assumption is the Minhag HaMedina as opposed to the Halacha of Yerush HaSa'av, that's reflective of the fact that the law of the Medina has kind of planted the default assumption, like, the default assumption should be we're following Halacha. And he's surprised it seems like the father or the grandfather, whatever you want to call it, is assuming that the default assumption is to not follow halacha.
Well, I mean, it sounds like the minhag intentionally evolved, like the minhag was to just follow the dina agayim on this thing, right? So why is that problematic? Isn't that just like a manifestation of a kol kaminhag hamedina? Yeah, Cole, you just got lost for a second. So let me tell you, I think there are three ways to try to go about making sense of this. Not all of these are inconsistent with what Cole was just laying out. So I think one way of reading this is that here he's talking to like the Chachmei Perpignan, and he's saying, look, you guys shouldn't have allowed it to come about that like your community by default just always follows the Dine HaGoyim, right? It's it should really depend, like, maybe case by case, you know, is there, like, a reason for them taking up the Dine Agayim? But, like, Lino Kane Bipneshu Mishpat Gayim B'emes Nir Lisha Aser. Al Kane Anu Po Timeim Makom HaMishpat B'Irchem Makom Tor V'Yisar Andas Echnosnu Yad L'Chlal Dvarim Elu. It's like, how did you allow things to come about that, I guess, like, your average person in the community just thinks that by default it's the non-Jewish law that's going to be controlling? I think that's one way of making sense of this. Like, he's turning to criticize the, you know, Anu Timeim Makom HaMishpat B'Irchem Makom Tor V'Yisar Andas. Like, why is it that you've just by default supplanted all of these areas of halacha? That's one way of looking at it. There are two other ways of looking at this, and I think the first one is that clearly different. So I think this, the way of saying this is that he's upset here by the reason for following the non-Jewish law. And, like, so you put a lot of stock on this word mipnei. So if the reason for following the non-Jewish custom is simply the fact of it being the non-Jewish law, then it's problematic. That, I think, is really interesting, because what matters then is, like, not the output, not, like, how the community is practicing, and not whether, you know, they're kind of using Choshen Mishpat or using the secular law or the secular practice, but, like, the reasons for their acting a certain way. So if their reason for doing it is just submission to the authority of the legislature or whoever makes the laws, then it's problematic. Like, Lino Kane Mipnei Shehu Mishpat Gayim Bemes Nir Lisha Aser. And that's what he has in mind. I think there's a third way to try to navigate the tension here, and that's to say, it's kind of related to the first, but it has to do with the scope of how much you're relying on the non-Jewish law. That doesn't pertain to this phrase over here, because I don't think it's supported by this phrase, but it's supported by what he says later. Let's see. I guess it's closer to what he talks about in the Dina de Malchus Adina section, where he talks about, you know, if you follow all these rules, then you're b'chlal oker kol dina Torah shlemo, ma'alanu l'sifri ha-kodesh ha-makudashim, she-chibru lanu rebi v'achar ravinu ravashi, right? Yilmadu es b'neim dina ha-goyim, v'yivnu lehem bamos tluos v'bate midrasei ha-goyim chalila, right? So it's saying that if you wanted to learn Jewish law, you should follow Shua and Mitnick and go to law school instead of going to yeshiva, right? That's kind of the argument here. And so, like, the concern is, like, this full-scale supplanting of Jewish law with non-Jewish law, but that would only be a problem if it's, like, so comprehensive, right? That, like, just by default, the assumption is that everything is following non-Jewish law, as opposed to a few customs here and there that are assimilated. So I think, just to summarize, I think there are three ways to try to navigate the tension here. Number one, I think, is that maybe you'll distinguish between him talking to the father in the case, like to the plaintiff, and him talking to the Chachmei Ha'ir. To the father, he says, yeah, of course, Kol Tanai Shev Mamon Kayim, of course, you have the right of way, that's the practice, Kol Kamenega Medina. But separately, he's criticizing the elders of the town and saying, you know, you guys should have done a better job keeping watch over, like, the halacha's norms having some manifestation. Way number two is to distinguish between what's the reason for following the non-Jewish law. If you're following the non-Jewish law for, like, efficiency reasons or because that's just the practice, that's kosher. If you're following the non-Jewish law because you think you're normatively bound by the non-Jewish law, that would be problematic on his view, and that might even call the validity of the agreement into question. And then number three would be about, like, this kind of full-scale supplanting. He's worried about the scope of substitution. So if there's going to be, like, a full-scale substitution of Jewish law for Minog, that might be problematic. But kind of local adoptions of custom might be okay. All right, let's hear from Zolti, and then let's hear some of your comments on this Rashba. Zolt?
Yeah, I tend to agree with, like, I think some of the earlier arguments, like, I think Cole, way of putting it, within the Rosh, but I think, what I think is interesting is that a lot of the discussion seems to turn around, like, a similar parallel discussion about Kukulcs Hagoyim, even though I think that's, like, technically it's a little bit different, but it's, but I think it turned around a similar discussion.
So I'm going to say, I don't think it's Kukulcs Hagoyim.
But it's not technically Kukulcs Hagoyim, because Kukulcs Hagoyim technically is not about din, it's about, like, the way you act.
The sources that he's citing and the language that he's mobilizing is all from the idea of Isser Kaos. So it's like a mechakes hagayim, like imitating the non-Jews, lifneim velo lifnei gayim, is all like borrowed from, like, I think it's Simon Chavav and the Rambam about the...
Sure, I agree with that, but I think it's, well, first of all, language at some point does switch. About limo mizel leilach medarkei hagayim umishpateim. Right, there clearly is some type of a dark Hagoyim language here too. It's like two paragraphs later.
Yeah, that could just mean like the ways of their laws, right? To follow their, but it's not
it
worried.
Could, but either way, I don't know if it matters that much. I think that the bigger point is, like, I think conceptually, I think the type of argumentation that are being used parallels a lot of that discussion there. Like, there's a lot of discussion with regards to dark Hagoyim, Chukulcs Hagoyim. How much is it a problem if you're like imitating things that make sense, things that don't make sense, right? It's like if you're wearing clothing because it makes sense to wear that clothing, you know, or is it a problem because they're specifically, anytime you copy what they're going to do, like a lot of the argumentation works the same way.
So what is that?
You know, I'd say that I think it's interesting in terms of analyzing the Rashba in that context. If you think about also like at what point would the Rashba say that even if you're not intentionally trying to copy the Goyim, if it looks like you're copying the Goyim, right? What time are we worried at what point about like Marakayim? About like losing the Torah and what it looks like.
Right. So I don't get that vibe at all from the Rashba. I don't see any concern about like incidental overlap.
Well, here it's clear that it's intentional.
Right. So Mipnei has
that. That seems to be obvious. But it's not, I mean, I don't think it's as clear though. If it's unintentional, the Rashba would necessarily be okay, especially if it is much larger or wholesale.
It's possible. It is possible. Minik, you wanted to comment?
I think Adam's first.
Adam?
Oh, Adam, you got it? The hymn was still up, but I think, well, I was going to say, it was basically already said in the chat, basically, I wonder what the line exactly is, at what point is he viewed that the Rabbanon have such an interest in the extent to which people are copying common practice of the Goyim. I mean, like, specifically by the question of Yerusha, the Torah might actually have specific interests, which may not, you know, fall the same type of category as when are you waking up in the morning to get to work.
Yeah. Want to flesh it out?
I mean, there's more assuming, I'm thinking here that perhaps the reason why he's making this statement at this point is to make us aware of this is perhaps the line. Directly in other cases, the reason why he also seems to support it, Kol Davar Shebet Mamo and Tano Kayam, the reason why he seems so willing to go along with it in general is because, yes, in truth, in the other sigilot in which we see this, there is, in fact, no real problem with it. But in a specific case, where we are starting to sort of alter not even just questions of Kosher Mishpat, but really get into questions of Yerodeh, again, to how Yerusha works, the Torah has specific interests.
Yeah, I think that's what Cole was saying in his WhatsApp message yesterday, that, like, some people think that this Rashba is uniquely motivated by the Yerusha problem, right? So it's like here there's like a specific halachic interest maybe in Yerusha Sabal, and maybe Yerusha Sabal is like more difficult to override, or it's like a specific Jewish value that shouldn't be overridden. So I think you could say, yeah, Linho Kane, like specifically on this one issue of Yerusha, would be problematic, right? Maybe that's kind of what he's getting at. But I think my one objection to that is still, how do you make sense of Mipnei Sheo Mishpat Gayim?
Well, right? There's another idea.
It becomes a little over-determined to say that, oh, it's in the case of Yerusha, and in Yerusha to do it Mipnei Sheo Mishpat Gayim, that's problematic, right? If it's problematic to tinker with the Torah's laws of Yerusha, which I think Gabe was getting at in his post on the chat, why should it matter that your reason for doing so is because, you know, that's the Minagagayim.
Well, there's already this sort of aspect of, it's like whenever there's something that you don't know what the practice of it came from, you just assume it's a Avodah Zarah. It's like, similar to this case, like, by case of Yerusha, if you're the one who's giving away your possessions after you die, you're not really getting, it's not really a transaction, you're not getting much out of it. So it doesn't fall to the common sense of, you know, oh, people getting up early in the morning because in a specific area, it makes sense to get up early in the morning to work. Here, there's no real reason why you should determine, you know, how you should give your money one way or the other.
Well, it sounds like there's a good reason, right? I mean, it sounds like you want to protect the wife's, like the wife's family and their assets.
What do you mean? No, that's in terms of him giving the dowry originally. I mean, in terms of, in general, how to...
That's the whole question. That's the whole question. The question here is that the father is claiming that there was an implicit condition made at the marriage. Okay? In virtue of whatever. I don't know. The father says in the... Can you people hear me? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, you're good.
Loud and clear.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. The father claims that everybody here, it's in the first line of the tshuva, the hare kola, or the first paragraph of the tshuva. Kevan sha kol yodim shem holchem bedine hagoy vere kol hanose isha esham ki ilu hasna kein. The father's saying, everybody knows that this is local practice, that we follow the goyim in this case. Now, the Rashba says explicitly that if that's empirically true, that this community has decided to practice a certain way, we have no problem with that. And even though I made a whole thing about, and I do think that some of the Rashba's harsh language is because this is an Isha's thing, there's Yerusha Sabal is virtually unique among inheritances in that it actually can be refused. Normally inheritance is betoken, inheritance rights are the result of a status, a blood status. That's not true for Yerusha Sabal. And it's an explicit Gemara in Suvis that you can get at the beginning of the fifth parak. The Baal can say no. So it's a Tanai Shabamon like any other in the marriage, at least, you know, according to Rabbi Yehuda. So there'd be no problem with that. The problem here is an explicit appeal to Gentile practice to suggest that, and otherwise, you know, Stam Torah contract was decided according to Gentile law. And that's what the Rashba doesn't like, is the appeal to Gentile practice when there's no empirical basis for it. It's just because, like, you know, it's like the, you know, it was like one of the tainas that the father had in his back pocket was that the Goyim behave like this. And that's what sends the Rashba over the edge. Because if you can make that kind of claim, then Torah law actually has no supremacy in monetary matters. It's a victim of whatever other legal ecosystems it's interacting with, you know, contextually.
Okay,
that's
but
the problem.
Cole, I would just say that. Oh,
that's okay, go ahead.
Go for it, Gabe.
No, I just think that's a bad reading of the Rashba. The Rashba is clearly bothered by the wholesale practice in the town, not by the father's claim or attempt to use this as a trump card in the negotiations. Is Tmei Makom Mishpat Be'irchem, Makom Torah. It's a communal practice. He's not.
Moshe Bar Yosef, Shabakol Makom Shenagula Hasnos Vlasos Gedat Torah. Filu Enosim Stam Govim Mehem Imesa Belo Banim Shekol Enosim Stam Aldasa Noeg Shem BeYisrael Enosa.
So the way I read this line, like, is like Gabe, kind of that he's totally fine with the father's claims. At this point, he's stepping back and he's saying, "Look, rabbis of Perpignan, you shouldn't allow your community to practice this way solely on the ground that it's the non-Jewish law, right? Like, it could be that like there's reasons for accepting this rule, right? Like, hey, we want to protect the wife's assets, right? People are, people aren't getting married or something because, like, the Nedunya is not protected. If that's the reason for enacting this practice, that's kosher. But if the reason for enacting the practice is because, like, that just happens to be the law of the land, that the Rashba finds problematic. That's my preferred reading of the text here. He's not even entertaining calling the Tanai into question. He's simply stepping back and addressing what Gabe called like communal policy, and he's saying if the minhag came about through some reason other than that it being mishpat agayim, that's kosher. It's to enact a minug simply because it's the Mishpat Agayim. That's where you infringe on this Isser of Shleich Hakes Agayim. Let's take Mitnick's hand because he's been so patient.
Sure. You can hear me, right? Because, I mean, you're really, really contorting yourself. I mean, the most straightforward reading is that he starts out saying, sounds good, and then he totally rejects it. I mean, he left out some of the ellipses, right, where he goes back and reinterprets the Gemara that he brought initially about Gamli Dar Aragya and the other stuff, right, or that the Shoal asked, right? So, basically, in the actual Shudabar, right, so he says that's not true because that was a special Sachaman and stuff like that. So he takes, if it was the case that this was a special issue and it was just kind of like an admonition that you guys should have more Torah in your communities, right, you wouldn't have to reinterpret those Gemaras. So he reinterprets those Gemaras because he actually thinks, so also that this is not going to work. And that fits with the way that in other Shudabar he explains Lashon Hegyo as being specifically common related and not related to common practice. I mean, the litmus test is like, what does he actually think the rule should be in this case, right? Like, does he ever say what the rule is? Like, if he says the rule is like, you guys are terrible, but like, okay, this is what they agreed upon, then I would agree with you, but I don't know that that's what comes out of this tshuva. I think what comes out of this tshuva is that the rule should be within the Torah, despite whatever hand-reading, you know, because of the hand-reading, not that, like, well, the rules are what you have to be, despite the hand-reading about, like, you know, not following Torah law.
So this is interesting. So Minik, your reading is that there's a full-scale retraction. Is that it? Like, there's a Havamina here about maybe we'll say Kol Tanaisha Mamon Kayam, maybe we'll say Kol Amasna Stam Adasa Noeg Shem B'Yisrael. And then he's saying, wait a second, that's all wrong. And then this is a retraction?
Yeah.
Can you just walk
because
me through
the stuff, because of his reinterpretation of the other Gemaras, of the Gamli Dar Aliyah and the Mithalbun Mars.
Okay,
right.
Let me talk about that for a second. But before, so I think two things. First of all, I want to hear just how you read the phrase. I want you to read this paragraph for me in a second. But second of all, I take issue with your formulation that he reinterprets the Gamli Daravya Sugya. I think what's happening there is that he never really engages that in the first half of the tshuva. Right, so he doesn't think that's necessary to make the guy's argument, and then he's saying, "By the way, I don't think Gamli Daravya is, I don't think that Gamli Daravya can substantiate the claim that it's permissible to follow like a non-Jewish custom simply because it's a non-Jewish custom, because like something else is going on in that Gemara."
I don't know why. Again, it's like really professional level ballet contortion. What he says is the reason in the Shuva, which again you don't have here. He says the reason why that's okay is because Mosten Locker does Minotaur, and he goes into that like a little bit, right? He doesn't really talk about whether it's because of DNA going or not, and the Ksuba Govman and Talmud especially, like that he could have just left as is because there's no indication that it was used. So the fact that he has to reinterpret those as being special, you know, or attributed to a Torah law inherently points to the fact that ultimately what his final disposition on this case is that you have to follow Torah law despite the initial push towards non-Torah law.
Ah, it's pretty interesting. Let me think about that for a second while you first tell me how you read the first half of the tshuva. How you read the Umikol Makom Linho Kane. I mean, so what's the transition here?
Sure, no, I mean, it reminds me, sorry to bring up law stuff, but like, right, so there's a tort of defamation and then the law of First Amendment, freedom of speech. And so there's like two things, there's like one legal and one like super legal, extra legal, like just some value of like, you can't, if you take it to its fullest extent, that would like go against their values. And then to figure out kind of how exactly that fits into the legal system. And that's what I think he's doing here. He's kind of saying, like, yeah, you're right. Like, within the legal system, it makes sense. But, like, if you take that to the extreme, like, that's insane. And you just, like, throw out all the Torah and just see what people do. So we have to figure out some kind of some kind of compromise, which kind of gets to towards the end. But I think here he's giving his whole throat an expression to that value that if his theory was taken to the extreme, it would go against.
That's an interesting point. I wanna address your reading of the Gamli Da Ravya point. So I'm just gonna add the part of the tshuva that you want me to add to the source sheet here. Why don't we just look at it inside here for a second, right?
Did you, Itamar? Can you indicate when you don't add the whole tshuva?
I had three dots here. I put in three dots here.
Ah, you're right. My bad.
So here, I'm just going to add it in right now, okay? Here's the missing part. So he says, anybody who brings a raya from Gamli Da Ravya is toa, right? And he says, because what's going on in that sugya is just... So he's saying you could be govek suva from mitaltalin. Chazal or gozer, or because an isha is not so mechdait on mitaltalin, we didn't allow collections from mitaltalin. But in these cases, in these areas of Aravia where all their business is in mitaltalin, and people are so mech on mitaltalin to collect debts, will allow her to collect debts, right? He says, that's what you get from that sugya, but you cannot infer from that sugya, avalil mob mizel leilich bedarkei agoy mishpateyem, chas v'shalom la'am kadosh lino kacha. So he's saying you can't infer from the Aravia case that we just follow the darkei agoy mishpateyem. So I think that's consistent with him allowing you to follow a practice of a minag medina that evolved just in conformity with the minag hagayim. He's just saying you can't use the Gemara and Ksivis of Gamli Da Ravya as evidence that the halacha will just naturally track the minag hagayim v'chukoseihem. That's how I read that part. You see that, Minik?
Yeah, no, all I'm saying is, I think that it's more than just saying, like, slap on the wrist, shame on you for letting this happen. Like, there is some legal import to his statement, and I think that this bears that out. It doesn't contradict that at all.
Yeah, the legal import to the statement is that it has to be the practice, I think. The legal import to there is legal import. It's not just. I don't think you two are disagreeing. It's not just a slap on the. Maybe there's an interesting question whether the Rashba. I agree with Mitnick that there's an interesting question whether the Rashba thinks it's usur, and then maybe something beyond that also legally invalid. That's an interesting question. Maybe everything turns on that. But I agree with Itamar that the problem here is not what the Rashba doesn't like is the appeal to Gentile practice, not the just de facto assimilation of Gentile practice. Minik, do you disagree with that?
No, I agree. All I'm saying is there any practical import to that? That's why I talked to the First Amendment. There's a First Amendment free speech, but it actually impacts the law. It applies right here, too. It's this is really bad. And I'm not just going to say it's really bad and hope for the best. I'm going to say that because this is really bad, it's also going to have legal import, and it's going to mean that you can't follow the non-Jewish law.
By the way, Usser could be assuming invalid. I wouldn't be surprised if that were true.
Right, I think that's Mitnick's point. Mitnick's trying to say,
Yeah, okay.
He's resisting my first point that this, or what Gabe was saying, and this is just a statement directed to the Chachmei Yair, shame on you. Right? He's saying, no, because of this.
Directed to the Chachmei Yair. In that sense, I don't think it is.
Minik's saying that because this, would undermine the independence of the Torah, that's a reason to invalidate these kinds of agreements. Right, Minik?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, and the point is, like, if he's using that to, like, show principle, which is that this can't be the way you're, like, full throated endorsement, like, that can't be, because otherwise we would just never have a Gemara. So the Gemara is clearly implying that, like, there's some limit on this, and let me try and express that limit.
Yeah, so I want to just push back on you for a second, Minik, because that the point that you just made, isn't that fully consistent with, like, what the Ramach was saying and what we saw in the beginning of our sugya, that Kol Kamina Kamadina, a lot of these dinim are here for defaults when there's no established minog, right? Like, so I'm not so moved by the Rashba's, like, reductio ad absurdum that, oh, then, well, we just all be we should just study the Minog Medina. Right. The counter argument is that, like, as Cole said, right, the halach is the sleeping sovereign, right? Its norms are binding whenever there's no nohag or takana or practice to the contrary. Like, why does Din Torah, it seems to me an open question about the scope of application of the Torah's rules before we can say that if they're not always being applied in all times and places, that we're being oker Din Torah. So, for example, I could have said that if Tanai Shev Mamon Kayim, then you're Oker Din Torah, because people could just opt out, right? So I'm not moved by, I don't see why we should be moved by the Rashba's argument.
I think the difference is in terms of the scope of how common the practice is, right? So in the Gemara that we're doing, right, this is everyday stuff. And it's not like if you have a dispute and you try to really drill down on what people meant. Like, it was a common practice every day, all day. Whereas here, you're looking for, like, these are, like, more in-depth disputes, and we're trying to figure out what the law is going to be. And so it's like looking into the law books rather than just, like, something you can look around and ask basically anybody about. The reason that's not nothing is that, like, one, that is the distinction that where the reductio ad absurdum makes sense, right? If you say, like, look, common practice every single day, this is what people do, then you're not going to be worried about suspending Torah law, which is going to be like, oh, there's a dispute. This guy's not exist. This guy's not that. You have such and such a rule. But if ultimately you replace, you know, there's no sleeping sovereign anymore because you made so many layers of sleeping sovereigns in the minute based on the non-Jewish law, based on the this, based on the that, and then, like, Torah really retreats so far to the background that it actually has no place whatsoever.
Right. I mean, but I think
the Rashba doesn't have a problem with it having no place whatsoever. He doesn't like the, what he wants is for, I'll say something cynical. The Rashba's fine with us doing what the Goyim do. It's a genealogy problem. It can't be caused by the wrong sort of thing.
Right, see, that's cool. I agree with you. I agree with you. Mitnick, though, is trying
to...
Mitnick's worried about, like, if the halacha is not finding day in and day out application across all cultures and times, it's oker dine Torah, right? Right, Mitnick?
It's my only answer. Okay, so you're on the bezin, right? So there's that bezin and there's the other bezin. And this is like the fault line between those bezin. So realistically, how often do you guys have to crack open a safer as opposed to consult a legal expert, right? It makes a real difference. It makes a real difference whether you're trying to tease it out of a shop and push a mishpah, or you look at some New York court case to tell you what the parties probably intended.
Okay, Minik, I'm gonna push back for a second, Minik. When's the last time we crack open a Yushalmi and Zrayim to decide a case in Choshen Mishpat? I don't think the normative force of Zrayim shouldn't depend on how many times it's cracked open to decide a practical question. Right? So you're saying the Akiras Din Torah depends on how many times a specific siman in Shulchan Aruch is cracked open to answer a question. Right?
And, well, my point is, what's your initial... I think that Rashba is saying throughout the ages, like, we've always, and, like, whether this is right or wrong or whatever, like, we've looked at, like, Torah law as, like, a first step, and if that changes, not only is it, like, it's bad and we should pump off hate, but that's just not what the practice has been. The practice has always been to look at Torah law first, maybe supplanted with widespread and hugging in certain small areas. So that's what he's saying, because that's always been the practice.
That's but you've just given a... But you've just given away the whole game. I mean, like, the it's an open question whether in a particular case practice is widespread enough that it should be consulted as opposed to the Shulchan Aruch.
Also, I agree with Cole, and I would add to that even, like, you are cracking open a Shulchan Aruch. You're cracking open the siman of a Kol Kamina
Gamadina. It's telling you to follow the minhag or not, you know, if it's not the minhag.
Right, Minik? I mean, isn't that an open question? Like, follow, like, what does it mean to follow Shulchan Aruch here? So you're following, is it Kolka Minak Amidina? Or is it like the indigenous principles?
I'm not saying that it's not halachic. Literature is what halacha said that we want. That's not what the Rashi is saying, right? Rashi is not worried about, like, you're not following halacha. His point is that there's no point in consulting halacha anymore. All halacha is going to be like, I don't know. Like, look around, ask the lawyer, ask the judge. Like, that's not, that's what the Rashi is worried about. And I don't think that you say, like, just because his language is so strong and you're going to throw it all out, that's what the only thing he's concerned about is full-scale supplantation. Like, that's just, like, embellishing on the concern of, like, what Torah is important and they should be consulted.
Yeah. I mean, now look, I think this is like the important, like, fault line. I'm not fully on board for your argument, Dominic. But I definitely hear where you're coming from, right? So I want to look now at how the Ramah takes this Shulchan Aruch. How the Ramah takes this Rashba. It appears in Simen Shin Samech Tes and Hilchos Gezeila. And he just says the following, right? And you could see he really, Mitnick, you'll find a friend in this Ramah, right? The Ramah here says, Hanose isha b'makom shedan in b'dinei avdei kochavim, humesa ishto, lo yuchal avi ishto, shor yorsha lomar, sorry, kol hanose isha al das aminagunose, v'nidon hadavar, v'nadun hadavar b'dinei avdei kochavim, de'emesa lo yorsha b'aylo chadomoze, v'leka b'zeh mishom dina d'machusa dina. So, this citation of the Rashba here, not only does it kind of agree with Mitnick's point that we would invalidate the Tanai if it's following Dine Agayim, it also gives no recognition to the first part of the Chuvas HaRashba. Right? It really just seems to run with the idea that it's problematic. Not only is it problematic, right, it invalidates the Tanai that was presumably used, or the minug that was presumably followed. Lo yuchal avi ishto oshor yorsha lomar kol anose ishal das haminug hunose v'naduna davar b'dini avdei kochavim. And then you just see the citation here is to the Chuvas HaRashba, so it's really this mystery, how do you get from the Chuvas HaRashba to here? I guess, Mitnick, your point is that this is the way you want to read the Rashba, right?
Yeah, I think what Michael was saying, like, ultimately, the litmus test here is what the Rashba actually thinks about that specific case, and I don't know if it was clear in the Chuvah, I didn't see it, if the Rashba actually agrees with the Ramah here, then you have to say that it's not just an adaptation.
Yeah. Anybody have thoughts on this Ramah? I mean, this Ramah is super strong. Gabe?
Yeah, this is my first time seeing the Ramah, and I'm trying to sort of defend the Ramah's reading here, so bear with me for a second. But perhaps the Ramah is reading the Rashba the way we did. Right? The Ramah would have settled the question, the shayla the Rashba received, and allowed the Tanai to be Kayam. But the outcome of the Rashba's policy statement is that nobody else should ever rely on Minag Medina or Chukas Hagoyim when it comes to Dina Yishus and Dina Yerusha. So going forward after that question, once the Rashba sort of postulates or legislates that you can't follow Dina Yerusha, this should never be possible in the future. You should never again be somech on Dina Goyim when getting married.
So it's like the Rashba's psak is...
It's kind of binding. Then we should never then... There can never be an assumption that you're following Minag Medina when it comes to these questions going forward once the Rashba passes. Or once they're my pastors. Theoretically, he has that power. That's a creative reading, so...
Yeah, but the question is, like, how does he get this out of the... Also, like, how does he get this out of the Rashba, right? Like, the Rashba himself started off with Kol Tanai Shev Mamon Kayam, and Gabe, you're saying that once the Rashba says that it's wrong to allow this minhag to come about, that's like a koveya l'dore doros, that it's wrong, and that like no Tanai should be... He doesn't even have the qualification as the Rashba had, like, if you did it just to follow the Dine Agayim, right? He says, if you do it, ben makom shedanim b'dine avdei kochavim, right? So even it sounds like if there's, I guess, an incident... Well, I don't know if this implies even an incidental overlap. You can't do that. The Tanai is invalid. So, as Minik was pointing out,
it could be as a substantive disagreement with the Rajba about the relative force of minag in different areas of halacha. In other words, I'm sympathetic to the thought that, like, I stand by everything I said about the Rajba up until now. It could be that what the Ramah here is, wait, this is the, I know Sasiisha, what you have highlighted is the Ramah or the Shulchan Aruch?
I have the Ramah.
Oh, you have the...
Bar Ilan doesn't distinguish between them. Bar Ilan doesn't distinguish between them.
Oh, okay. I think it's perfectly plausible to say that what the Ramah here is saying is that the particular, or maybe this is the way he read the Rajba, although it's not the way I did, the particular area of Yerusha Sabal is insulated from Minag in a way that other things are not. Because, you know, common practice is not determinative. Well, that would be what it would be, is common practice is not determinative for Yerusha Sabal in a way that it is for, in a way that the Rama might think it is for other areas of halakha. And in which case you would need an explicit Tanai and couldn't just say that common practice is dispositive.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but it's still a mystery how he gets that out of the Rashba himself, right?
I'm not a historian. I don't.
Right, you're not interested in that question.
That's for people who know something about the Ramah.
Right. I would just say one thing. I think that you might say here to defend the reading of the Rashba is that this opening phrase is stronger than the Rashba's statement, and so maybe it tacitly incorporates the idea that, you know, we're dealing with an area where they just follow the law because it's the law. In which case, under those conditions, Hanosa Isha Makom Shadan in Bedine of De Kochavim, so there's just like a full scale capitulation to non Jewish law, then you can't argue that that's automatically binding on the Jewish community. Whereas, like, the Rashba's point is, so then this is sort of like Minnick's reading, where the Rashba is like intentionally trying to distinguish between, I guess, if in most cases you're following Jewish law, and just here and there there's like a reason to accept the Minhag HaMedina, or even on my reading, where in some cases you follow the Minhag HaMedina because it's efficient or it seems fair, rather than for it being the law, then the Tanai is binding. But if there's just like a full-scale incorporation of the non-Jewish law, then that would be invalidated by halakha. So maybe like one way to solve the problem.
This Ramah is excellent evidence for the view that minhag does not derive its force from estimates about das. Because there's no question that in an area in which there's wholesale incorporation of Gentile law, that people are getting married al das. Minagagoyan. But it's precisely in such a case where the Ramah's reaction to Minagagoyan is strongest in the negative. It's right, that which is an interesting but it seems pretty obvious from this passage that,
yeah.
So,
yeah. Anybody else have thoughts? Shua, you have thoughts on this? Shua? See?
Sorry, I'm just recovering from a bad cold this weekend. So I'm a little
COVID.
This morning.
Looks like he's got COVID.
Yeah, I got tested, so it's not COVID, but it's pretty rough. I think that my reaction, I don't have specific thoughts about the... I mean, I think Yoni's right that his is a little bit more... His take is a little bit more simple and tracks through a little bit more, but I think that maybe because I'm the most Hasidish member of the Chabura, which is something I've never said before in my life, but it's for sure true here. I think that my question is like, is if I think if we better understood the reason for this halakha or orientation, we would have like a, it would be a little bit easier to deduce what the Rashba wanted from us. Like if like some of the questions that we dealt with last time, which is like not, they're not, it's not in the text here. It's more of a kind of like abstract philosophical question. But if we understood why it was that we were so antagonistic to allowing like law of some alternative forum to overtake halacha, right? If we had like some for the not for the Rashba statement, for the like first instance reasons that we say like kind of the questions we dealt with last time, then I think we would have an easier time understanding why, how, like why Yerusha would be different, or how it tracks specifically in cases where people are appealing to the law qua law versus appealing to law as minog. I just think it would be easier to tease out if we came in with an orientation toward why it matters, right? I could just set it up, right? If the entire issue is along the lines of the Rashba's, like we're going to stop learning, Torah is going to stop being important, which, as an aside, I agree to your point that like this is, we generally don't claim that the importance of Torah is based on its like normative legal value, so your Zerug point is solid. But if that was our issue, if our issue was that for some metaphysical or legalistic or cultural reason, the idea of stopping to follow all of Kosher Mishmud was especially was very stressful for us, right? Then I think Yodi's point is very strong, right? Then you can say, okay, so clearly we can't allow that to happen for halachic or metahalachic reasons.
Okay, but I just want to bracket this because I think it's imprecise to say that like stop. I think it's imprecise to say we're stopping to follow Kosher Mishmud. Because Kosher Mishpat itself is what provides for following Kol Kamina Gamadina.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, again, like, think about it in terms of, like, a purely, like, tells, maybe, if you think that halacha is, like, the practice and study of, like, halachic specifics is the way to approach, like, I don't know, not to take this gemara away from what it's supposed to be, but like the way to approach godliness or you know, or havayas davayim rabba is how you become a navi. So then crowding it out or leaving just the rule that like, oh yeah, we follow minhag when it exists, Cole's rolling his eyes at me.
I actually agree with what you're saying. I mean, it's awfully religious, but
I think it's true. Like, you have to think of it.
Yeah, I agree with Shua.
See,
yeah,
Shua, I disagree. I disagree because what you're doing here, Shua, is you're bifurcating Havayos Davaya Varava into like every simon except for Hakol Kiminaga Medina, and saying like when we think about what the halacha wants of us, we think of every simon except for Hakol Kiminaga Medina, and we're trying to figure out how like the Jewish system.
It's not realistic to have one kind of. Like, what's burning Hakol Kiminaga Medina? You're taking it outside of another law, and you're kind of setting it up as like a structural framework that exists pre, like, asserting or assessing halacha, right? I mean, obviously not, I don't think that that's obvious, but that's how it's going to end up functioning. And so you're right that, like, can you convince, like, it's the halacha, so, but generally, I don't think that that's how the halachic system views exceptions. We don't. I mean, I think sometimes people catch it because it makes them feel good. But like, we don't say, halal shalas achas kadesh yishmeru, shavas as harbe is a specific siman of Shulchan Aruch that fits with our, like, it's a recognition. It's like a recognized exception, not a definitional.
Itamar, I just think Shua is like obviously right that the Itamar and I usually don't disagree. This is like uncomfortable for me, but this is a Kol Kamenaga Medina is real theory. It's not ideal theory.
See, this I'm not sure about. This I'm not sure about, right? I mean...
I just think it's so obvious that that's true. The Torah is envisioning a sovereign Jewish state following laws that we as individuals have the power at the monetary level to change because of Tanai. Not to change, but to kind of move around in because of Tanai. But Tanai is exactly what we don't want to say Minhag HaMedina is.
So I'm not persuaded. I'm not fully convinced by that, because I think, why couldn't you say... The Torah says, "Hamocher as abayis, are you also mocher as achatzer?" There's that. That's not like a substantive halachic commitment for Shua's like religious, you know, explorations to figure out whether in the halachic metaphysics abayis includes the chatzer, and abayis includes a chandelier, and the sfina includes the sail, etc., etc. I mean, you need rules, just like if someone doesn't specify, but like.
I come back to what I said, I think, last night, which is, or two times ago, which is admittedly not based in like, I don't think we've seen anything to prove this yet, but it's a fit that, a skeleton that kind of works well for me, which is that we want to allow for dynamics when reality calls for it, right? We want halacha to be able to move with the monetary, like the same way, I don't know, Rav Shimon has this thing in Shari Yosher about letting Darabanan definitions of like monetary things impact how Daraisa's function, right? And his point is that things change and our conception of money changes and our conception of or things like that change, and we have to allow for some flexibility within the halakhic system. And that, I think, Hakol Kamenag HaMedina does very well, because it takes into account that there will be, like our first, like our Paulin example, situations that will call for Minhag to circumvent what the ideal situation, like value set, would be.
Okay,
but that's different than crowding out an entire section of Shulchan Aruch. That's different than like.
I think everything they I like what you're saying, Shua. I just think it's too theory laden, and it runs too much with this idea that Hakol Kamenag HaMedina is like this exceptional rule, like a drabanan to update every now and then. I just don't know how you know that Minhag HaMedina is this.
Right? Either you can come from a top-down theory approach, in which case I think I described it very well, or you can take a bottom-up textual approach, and I think Mimic's read is very precise. I think you're kind of stuck somewhere in the middle right now.
My view?
Yeah.
The view, my view...
Lachtay seemed to say that the Rajba was like, not saying what he thought the halacha was, but was just like lecturing a bunch of people on policy.
I don't think it has to be just that. I think you could defend my view that the Rosh was saying Kol Tanai Shel Momon Kayim Kol Amas Nesnama Daita De Minhag, because Minhag is part of like the first order halacha, right? So like the prescription of Choshen Mishpat is B'Mokom She'ein Minhag do X, B'Mokom She'yesh Minhag do Y. Right, as all that's part of like the first order halacha, but the Rashba is saying here's one proviso, right? Minhag is not legitimate if it's done solely because it's the non-Jewish law. Now, why is that? Because you know the Torah talks about our kos. What's that?
I get it, and you should tell me if I'm taking us off base here. One of the reasons I didn't speak up earlier is I felt like this was maybe a little bit of the weeds, but. We're not in the weeds, in the sky, maybe. But I don't understand the reality where the Rajba tells the Chachmei Perignon, like, how to tell people how to Yarshin. It just seems like a very strict, like, are these people, they're like, getting rid of Yerushas Habal because that's what the Goyim do and they think it's cool? Like, are they doing it because, like, it just makes sense to them because that's the cultural milieu that they were brought up? Like what's... It's not the type of Tanai that, like, you have to explain to me why they were doing it in the first place.
So here's the classic example, right? So, like, if you read the Ray Willig piece, and we'll discuss it next time. So, like, the reason why all poskim, like, are hot on this topic is because it's, like, when you get divorced, so, like, which system of law are you going to use to decide division of assets, right? Equitable distribution or whatever. Or are you going to use like Nidunya and Nechse Milug and Baba Nechse Ishto and all those things, right? So, Rabbi Willig says straight up, he's like, in a modern Orthodox community, people get married. No one's thinking in terms of Nechse Milug, Nechse Tzom Barzel. They know, they come into marriage, they're gonna leave the marriage with like some equitable distribution. That's what the courts do, that's what their friends do. That's their expectation, right? So now we have two questions in my mind. One is the legal question. You get divorced. Which system of law is halachically appropriate to apply? Which rule is halachically appropriate to apply? All right, Willig's view is that you apply equitable distribution because, like, that's like the minhag in all modern Orthodox circles. That's what, you know, people's parents, you know, applied when they got divorced, you know, et cetera, et cetera. No person getting married in a modern Orthodox community is thinking in terms of like Nichse Milug and Nidunyas and things like that. Now,
Itamar, Shua can agree.
One second. I'm just trying to motivate the example for Shua. Now, you could see a posek turning to Willig and saying, like, what's wrong with you, why you rabbis? Like, why can't you educate your community to learn, like, Hilchus Ksavis, so that they know that there are rules of Nidunya? How did you let it come about such that everyone's thinking in terms of equitable distribution? So horrible. Now, I'm thinking, like, that's what's going on with the Rashba. The Rashba is saying, like, yes, like, de facto, everyone here does X, that's the practice, that's the law, that's the substantive law that you should apply. But, like, gee, Perpignan, like, what's wrong with you guys? Like, how did you forget about, like, our Mesora?
No, I get that the best that you guys are insecure about the Muncie and Brooklyn people who actually do halacha, but still, there's no, it's like a catch-22. There's no such situation, I think. Rabbi Willig, who probably agrees with your articulation of what the Rashba would have said to him, right? He's a pretty yeshivish guy. But he knows that he could try Chai V'Kayom from today till tomorrow and write 100 shuvas with language even stronger than the Rashba's, and nothing would change because it's not like a Yumanav Shach. If you're the type of community that falls into this practice, probably what the Rabbanim are coaching you on is not going to change anything, right? There's a reason this has become the minhag. Now, again, I don't know. I don't know what Southern France is like in 13th century, 14th century, whatever. Like, you could, I'm sure you know better than me, and I'd be interested to hear because it might be relevant. But in terms of like hierarchical rabbinic communities, but my assumption from reading this Rashba is that, in your voice, is that I just don't understand how this changes anything or even, like, makes sense to reflect our goals in avoiding, like minhag, right? Like, if they started doing this, take the modern order, if they started doing equitable distributions, they started doing it because they thought it made the most sense for them, right? And if that's the whole point of Holkanacha and Minog and Minog Mabata Halacha and everything else we've spoken about, so I'm very proud that they used this lever of Halacha that you set out for them to do exactly what they need.
I agree. So, that's why I read the Rashba as saying that, the Rashba is saying, like, look, modern Orthodox Jews, women work, right? They make their own income. They're not expecting just to be left with, like, the horse that they brought into the marriage, right? So that's why in modern Orthodox circles, you'll find equitable distribution being applied more than the laws of the halacha, which assume like a different kind of reality of what's being brought into the marriage. I think the Rashba would say, and we'll see that some people interpret the Rashba, say that's kosher, right? Because you're not following equitable distribution simply because Governor Cuomo declared it as law, right? Him and like Sheldon, right? Who is the speaker of like...
Shelley Silver,
right? It's like, you're not following
Shua
it.
Shua is like neighbors with that guy, no?
He's Lower East Side, right? So you're not following it. So I think on my reading of the Rashba, he would only criticize it if the reason for following equitable distribution is that we love American law, right? But if the reason why we follow it is because it reflects a certain reasonable practice given the expectations and the marketplace that we live in, and that's kosher.
I don't understand what you don't understand.
No,
the first thing you said, I mean, yeah, I think what Itamar just said right now is obviously correct. I also think that what
Shua said, hold on, Itamar. I just think that what Shua said a few minutes ago, Itamar, a reductio, and it's barely a reductio, I'm being charitable, but a reductio of your view is that it doesn't matter what it says in the Torah. It's just, you're taking my, I feel as though you're like almost parodying my sleeping sovereign view. Like, it's true that the baseline that the Torah set can be in Chosh and Mishnah can be overridden by Minog, but that doesn't mean that the baseline was itself arbitrary. It just means that there are other things like contingent historical reality, which matters way more in certain areas of law, like Chosh and Mishpat, than others, like Yeridea. Plus, like, individual preference, again, seems like economics should take it into account. Ritual, for very good reasons, should not. I think that the laws in Chosh and Mishpat embody certain values. One of the values they embody is that people should, broadly speaking, have control over their property and shouldn't be held to standards that are totally foreign to them.
I agree with that, Cole. I agree with that. I don't think I don't think there's anything in my view that recognizes the Kol Kamina Medina as a first order principle of Chosh and Mishpat. I don't think that commits me to reducing the other rules of Chosh and Mishpat to arbitrary default rules. I don't think that there's anything in my view that commits me to that.
I do think that a Kol Kamina Medina is exceptional in the sense that it's not the baseline. It's a way of changing. It is a meta standard for changing the baseline, but that puts it not on par with substantive law. It puts it one level up.
Yeah,
which doesn't mean that it's not important. It just means that it's not ideal. The ideal is the baseline. Even if we have discretion to, it's a justifications, excuses type distinction. I have to go eat dinner or I will starve.
All right, let's hear briefly from Evan and Yoni. Both of them had hands. And then I want to make one more comment. Evan?
Call out a leave, which is unfortunate because I was going to ask him to just explain what he just meant. But at least from all the sources we've seen so far, the baseline that Kol Minog is working over can either be set as itself somehow, like from halakha, like, oh, the halakha mandates the baseline be the minhag, or as we saw early on, that the baseline is some like din d'oraisa or whatnot. And then I just think the whole stemming conversation doesn't make much, or at least the rest of his point, where the baseline becomes the fault or the baseline becomes the ideal. Well, if it's whether it's Din Torah or it's Halakha pointing in a direction, neither of those are the ideal, or rather the fault. And then I guess the argument just kind of continues.
Well, I'm not sure I would contrast ideal versus default. I think Cole and Shua, or at least certainly Shua and Cole, were trying to say that there's a distinction between like the default rules of the halakha are the ideal rules, and then there are these concessions to reality that diverge from the ideal rules. And a Kol Kamina Gamadina should be viewed as like a non-ideal concession to circumstance. Right? I think that's how Shua is viewing it. Right, Shua? Even if it's a first order principle of halacha, it's a first order principle that allows us to concede to circumstances here and there.
Right, but and then in either case, I think you can say that there's still a baseline, though. There is still something that the Torah or Din Torah would say you should do, but we are doing that concede. Like, I don't know, I guess not, but I think even in the more obscure cases where the Din Torah would point you in a direction opposite of the minhag, you could still say that, well, there's a baseline, and then the baseline is not an ideal, and we're following some other concession, as opposed to saying there isn't really a baseline and we're just following the concession.
Yeah, I need to think about that a little bit. I think there are two separate issues here about like what's the baseline and what are you allowed to change from? And this question of like, what's the ideal and what's like the non-ideal? So I think you have to figure out what's the relationship between those two separate things.
Right.
Zolt, let's give you a comment, and I just want to make one quick point.
Oh, I don't remember. It was a while ago already, honestly. I was going to say at some point, I tend to agree with your perception of like the way that Minak plays its role in Halacha.
With my conception.
Yeah, I think I agree with your view. I think that the problem with your view, like the question has to be dealt with, and I think it's more difficult, is when, like, which minhagim that the Torah thinks are inherent to the system? Like, which things come with the house? Like, I think that's clearly, like, something that the Torah would say, or Allah would say that's something that should be determined by minhag, unless there's an absence of minhag. But, like, I don't know, like, the question is, like, where are the boundaries? Like, is Yerusha something that, you know, minhag should have a role in, or ideally it shouldn't have a role? Like, I think you have to think those boundaries, you know, the extent.
Yeah.
Is going to be the question that we have to really deal with.
Like, I agree with that. So it might be, like, tchum by tchum area where you have to figure out, like, is Shua right or am I right? So maybe Shua is right, like, in some areas where there's an ideal, and, you know, maybe you're allowed to deviate here and there. And some areas where, like, the Torah is really just kind of setting up defaults, but not makbid, right? Like, I think that's very possible, and we should be sensitive to that. We'll see. Rav Asher Weiss has, like, a comment along those lines.
Yeah. I would say, like, there's one thing I've been thinking about a lot throughout, like, this again. I thought about it last year, too. It's that it's surprising if minhag really does have this role. It's kind of the pushback against this view. If minhag, and this really gets support, I guess, like Shua's view, if minhag really did have such a big role in halacha, you'd expect a lot more literature. Like, there's very little. Like, we're quoting, like, a Farash Bahir, like, a Marik here. Like, there's just very little. This is not a lot for something that seems to be so, you know, game-changing.
So what do you mean by literature? Like, do you mean, like, Talmudic prominence? Like, the Gemara
everywhere? Not just Talmudic. Even just, like, tshuvas. Like, you just expect a lot more tshuvas to deal with this.
Do you mean,
like, it should take up a large, much larger part of Choshen Mishpat. A lot more tshuvas, like, over the years, should have been talking about this.
I mean, I don't know the history of Shas and Tshuvas Svarim, but if this were here, you would think that every Choshen Mishpat tshuva ever would have to reflect on the minhag of the place in answering any question.
And you think that's empirically
false? I don't know if it's
false.
Every single one, but definitely a lot more than, like, a dozen. And this is a handful at most here we're looking at. They're not nearly as many as you expect.
It's interesting. I mean, there are a few ways to answer that question. The easiest is that, like, oftentimes, like, if you lived in a shtetl or, like, an insular Jewish community, your minhag didn't diverge from, you know, kind of what Shulchan Aruch prescribes, right? You have to live in, like, a very strong legal culture where, like, the laws are really accessible and people are following these public laws.
Okay, so for, like, the last, like, 200-plus years since, like, the Jews left the ghetto, you'd expect a lot more tshuvas about this.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you're tracing minhag, you'd find...
But, like, why are there more tshuvas on, like, Eruvs than there are on this?
I don't know. I'm not really sure, like, the method of the question. But I would say that, like, you don't have to have a lot of discussion to keep referring to minhag ha-medina. I think if you look... People say, if you look at, like, Bate Din Pinkasim from Europe, like, they never gave, like, halachic reasons. They just said, like, this was the dispute, this is the answer, and, you know, it's not, they weren't written like Shilas and Tshuvas. Shilas and Tshuvas is, like, a specific genre of, like, halachic writing, right? I mean, Nick, it looks like you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, once the Jews left together, they didn't care what the Din said, but also, we shouldn't judge based on, like, what we said. I mean, this is, like, curated list of people who talk about the issue in specific instances, but correct me if I'm wrong, but they're not all the time that Choshen Mishpat talks about we can check it out, but it comes up over and over again in just like places that we wouldn't necessarily have read in our yeshiva, you know, all of these education.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me just make one last point, unless, Gabe, did you want to say something before I make my last point?
I just wanted to echo the point that it's important to think about this tchum by tchum, and I think Yerusha is a really interesting test case because it's a hybrid of of a server head there and push in Mishpat. And that was the Rambam that I cited earlier, I think.
Chukas.
On the borders.
Chukas Mishpat, right? Yeah, exactly. So let me just make one last point. I want to just close by sketching the Rivash here in Siman Nun Beis. So you recall the Rivash here says, according to the halacha, the halachic rules of Yerusha, once you have a Yoresh, you can't really take the Nechasim back from him, right? You're locked into the Yoresh's line of inheritance. So if I give all my Yerusha to my brother, so the Yerusha then follows my brother's line, right? I can't give it to my brother and then say Acharecha Laploni. But the Rivash was asked about this case of a dispute between two Jews who actually seem to be living as non-Jews. So I guess they were Mishumadim. So these are like Mitniks, people who are emancipated from the ghetto. These are like Mitniks, Jews who are emancipated from the ghetto. They're living as non-Jews. And it seems like the law in Majorca was that you could do that. You could do a nechasai leploni v'acharecha to somebody else, right? So the Rivash was asked this question, and he says, it's true that the halacha says that kivan sherishon roi liyarsho di yerusha ein lahefzik. It automatically follows that line. You can't take it away. Ze haya emes im haya nasa ben Yehudim b'makom shedanim dineim b'dine Yisrael. Aval hamitzave hazeh, this guy, this bequeather, hayadar bin Majorca, b'chezkas ove kochavim. V'ha'isha habal leirish mikoach hatzava, gam hisham b'chezkas nacharis. So he's saying, A, they were all living as non-Jews. V'gam b'yahadusam, and even when they lived as Jews, hayalahem ladin b'dine ove de kochavim, kichein nahagu me'olam kahal Majorca mirtsonam. So since the Jews in Majorca like voluntarily abided by like the Majorcan law, which was to, I guess, allow for this acharecha leploni provision, imkein eich yelech v'yisam imkomo echad mishtei akitos v'yelech eretz merchakim sheyadinu lo b'dine Yisrael. Yavo b'Majorca lefnei adayin shalahem shehu agizbar u'misha yizaka b'yachzikeyu agizbar b'nichzei amorish hu ayorish. So you can see here, like, the Rivash is totally comfortable not enforcing, like, the Torah's provisions on the ground that business was done in Majorca, where the Kehillah's custom was to follow the non-Jewish law, which allows for this, and moreover, that they were living as kind of non-Jews, not intending to be bound by Jewish law, right? So I think that's, like, a really striking... This is even within the realm of Yerusha, the Rivash is willing to allow for this kind of provision, just on the ground that kichei noagu meolam kahal meyorka mirtsonam. Right, so saregel achas. I mean, that's a really striking formulation. Right, I think Zecharia said it's like a really wild Rivash. Right, so we'll talk about this the Rivash on Thursday. Okay, and then I want to wrap up this question. Take a look at the Ray Willig article and the Ray Reese article, and I'm going to send out something else from Ray Bleich. But a lot, you can see all like these contemporary debates turned on this tension between the Tshuvas HaRashba and how the Ramah cites it. And I think on this more philosophical principle that Shua and Cole were kind of debating, and that Mitnick was getting at in the beginning about like whether this yielding to Minog really would constitute a kind of Akira of Divrei Torah. So, all right, good. Anybody have last thoughts before we sign off? Okay, so let's pick up on Thursday with this discussion. Shkoyach, everyone. Very good.